Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and I'm here with one of my favorite guys in the world, Arch Campbell.
And I'm here with one of my favorite guys, Jason Fraley. Literally, it's great to talk to you, always. I love talking to you because you know movies. And you came up and introduced yourself to me and said you used to watch me on TV, and I was so grateful that you and I have been friends ever since.
It's rare. It's been an odd couple. Are we Oscar and Felix or Oscar and Oscar? Because it's movies.
I think we're sort of movie father and son.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe grandfather and father now.
True. I'll take it. Yeah. No. I mean, you mentioned I watched you growing up because I grew up in Frederick, Maryland, and you were a staple there at Channel 4. It was Vance and Doreen, and we had George Michael.
Ryan.
God, the late, rest his soul, as in sports machine, all that. Bob Ryan doing weather, you doing movies. It was the Titans.
People remember me from the 11 o'clock news on Channel 4 because nobody realized it at the time, but we had complete program flow. You had Vance and Doreen doing the news, and then you had Bob Ryan doing the weather, then you had George Michael, then you went to me, and then we went into either Johnny Carson or Jay Leno, and so the thing completely flowed from the hard-edge news through the weather to the sports, and then to me, I was sort of the punctuation mark at the end.
You were the lead into Carson, though.
Yeah.
How does that feel? I mean, leading into Carson, and this was at a time when more people watched local news too. They didn't have the internet and all this other stuff. So
it was totally random. Literally, I became a movie reviewer because I worked in a television newsroom in Dallas, and the news director came in one day, and said, "I want a movie reviewer. Who wants to do it?" And nobody did, so I raised my hand and I became the movie reviewer. Yeah. And at the in those days, the 70s, when I was in TV news to begin with, you had to be a generalist. You had to be able to go out and do everything. There used to be a famous cartoon where you're in a newsroom and there's a dartboard up there with education, government, crime, sports, and you throw the dart and wherever it lands, that's what you do that day.
Your dart hit movies.
And I have made a point to always ask other reviewers how they got to be the movie reviewer. Mm-hmm. And many of them from my age, that's what it was. They were in a newsroom and somebody said, who wants to do the movies this week? And they said, okay, fine. Judith Crist, that's her story.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Judith Crist used to be one of the people I really admired. Judith Crist and of course, Roger Ebert.
Yeah.
Now, Ebert's story is different, but that's my story. I raised my hand.
Mine was a little bit different. I was here on the WTOP news desk writing the morning show for Mike and Bruce. Now it's Mike and Joan. And, I was getting my master's right across the street at AU at the time. So everyone sort of, I guess, knew I loved movies, buff and all that stuff. But for me, it was the passing of Joe Barber. He passed away. What a sweet guy.
Joe Barber was like a savant. I mean, he was a walking encyclopedia. He knew more about the movies. Any question you had, he would answer.
Yeah.
Even we'd be sitting around waiting for a movie to start, and I'd be sitting next to Jane Horowitz or somebody, and we'd say, "What was that movie? What was it?" Joe would turn around and give us the answer,
just like that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Joe had a famous segment on WTOP on Saturday mornings where they kind of let him go wild, and he stayed here all Saturday morning. He was also a great friend to Tony Kornheiser.
Yeah.
And Kornheiser, for a while, did his show from these studios, and Joe would wander over there. And Joe is a great loss.
It was a huge loss. I remember he would come in here, I think, and I'm pretty sure David Byrd would be in here. David Byrd did the eulogy, I remember. And just listen to those guys go back and forth, and Joe would just take it on a, they were there to talk about the new movie, and then a couple minutes he'd say, "Well, let me tell you about the gunfight at the OK Corral." But that's when I, as a young guy in the newsroom, I would like perk up, because these are the old movies that I would love. So I always had an affection for Joe, and it was sad that he's a young guy. What was he, in his 60s probably when he passed?
I think he was in his 50s. He died very young.
Yeah.
I grew to love the movies because of the time in which I grew up. And those were the days when television first came in.
Tell our listeners where you grew up.
I grew up in San Antonio, Texas.
What year were you born, if you don't mind?
I was born in 1946.
Woohoo! Best years of our lives. It's a Wonderful Life.
It's a Wonderful Life. It's a Wonderful Life would play on television, and my father, who was a movie buff and who spent his depression years going to the movies, because that's what people did, would say, okay, now It's a Wonderful Life is coming on, and you need to watch that because that's a good movie. At the time, when television first started in the 40s and early 50s, they cut a deal with Hollywood where they would only show movies made before 1948.
Interesting.
So they were showing all the classics.
The Wizard of Oz.
They were showing all of the Frank Capra movies, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, Meet John Doe. They were showing You Can't Take It With You. It Happened One Night. All of those were on television, the Hitchcock movies. And in the late 50s, I learned from my friend. I made friends with Count Gore Duvall here in Washington.
You've seen him on his show, man.
Count Gore, my dear friend. Universal Pictures in the late 50s put together a package that they sold to local television of horror films. It was, I think they called it the Shock Theater package. Okay. And my station in San Antonio started Shock Theater in the middle 50s. First movie they showed was Frankenstein. My father, my mother.
The Boris Karloff one?
The original Frankenstein. We stayed up to watch Frankenstein. The next week was Dracula. The week after that was The Invisible Man. Then The Wolfman, which is one of my favorite films. And then The Son of Frankenstein and Dracula's Daughter. Yeah. And all of those movies, I loved watching them. And that's how I learned to love the movies.
So you fell in love with Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff and all of those guys. Interesting.
Claude Rains is the Invisible Man.
Yeah.
Casablanca, he's the best friend. Lon Chaney is the Wolf Man.
Yeah. Talk about an underrated actor, Claude Rains.
Oh,
he was
man.
In everything.
He was the greatest. He's in Notorious. What a great movie. The Hitchcock movie, Notorious.
One of the underrated ones, I feel like, right?
You know, Ingrid Bergman is despondent because her father's been arrested for treason, and they recruit her to spy on the Nazis in South America.
In Rio, and Cary Grant falls for her. But yeah.
And then Claude Rains falls for her and marries her, and the mother back there. Studying up on this. Madame Constantine. That was her acting name.
Yeah.
She knows something's up, and she figures out that Ingrid is a spy. And they start
drugging her.
Yeah, he goes to her. He says, Mother, I've made a terrible thing. She's a spy. And then the mother says, one of my favorite lines in the movies is from Notorious. The mother says to Claude Rains, we are protected by the enormity of your stupidity. My wife and I quote that to each other all the time.
I want that on my headstone.
And in my career, actually, I was protected by the enormity of my stupidity. Because when I finally got the movie deal on Channel 4, I was not an expert. And I figured the only way I could last is by taking the average guy approach and giving a clear message. And that worked for me at that time. Now I think it's a different time. Now I think you need to be an expert and have probably a deeper background than I had. But my background is watching classic films on television when I was growing up. And when I first came to Washington, I got the movie deal down in Dallas, and I was reviewing in Dallas. I moved up here. I had joined the American Film Institute to get their magazine. I think it was American Film Magazine.
Yeah.
So I came to Washington. The AFI had a theater here in Kennedy Center. I would go to the AFI theater 2 to 3 nights a week to watch the classics. They'd have an Orson Welles festival. I was at the...
They still do that at AFI Silver, yeah.
There is a famous night among film buffs involving the AFI in, I think, 1975. They had a showing of The Lady from Shanghai.
Oh.
And we walked in, and they're excited, and they whisper, we've got a nitrate print. A nitrate print. This is like a special nitrate print. So we sit down to watch The Lady from Shanghai, and the famous scene at
the mirrors.
They're in the fun house, and they're shooting each other with the mirrors. And the film goes to the last reel. So Rita Hayworth is driving a 46 Lincoln Continental Mark I to the fun house to have her scene. And the film skips. And we're all in the AFI. And then the film melts from the inside.
Oh,
you know,
no.
The frame stops and melts. And then the theater goes dark, and I turn around, and you see the top reel catch on fire. And they sounded the fire alarm. They opened the doors, and they evacuated the entire Kennedy Center because the last reel of The Lady from Shanghai had caught fire.
Oh, no. Was this before the mirror shootout or during?
Yeah, I didn't get to see
it. You didn't see the mirror shootout?
I went there because I wanted to see the famous mirror shootout scene. Didn't get to see it. It was like 20 years later
before I could
see it.
But you've seen the infamous theater fire scene.
To show you how different times are.
Yeah.
That was not reported in the news.
Wow.
You know, it would be breaking news
today. It'd be all
on
Twitter right now, yeah.
Oh, my God. You know, Kennedy Center, there's a fire at Kennedy Center.
WTOP would be there.
Nothing. Wow. Nobody said anything.
That's wild. I want to move let's back it up a little bit. I would love to move a little more let's go chronological so I can keep it all in my brain.
Okay.
So you're born in 46.
Born in 1946.
Tell me in Dallas or Austin?
San Antonio, Texas.
What did your parents do?
My father was a salesman. He sold a lot of different things. My mother was she was a government worker. She moved to San Antonio to room with a friend who had moved to San Antonio thinking she was engaged, and it turned out she wasn't. So my mother's friend wrote her in Nashville and said, "You've got to come here, and we've got to find husbands."
Wow.
So my mother and father worked at Fort Sam Houston. They got married, then my father became a salesman.
Yeah.
Later in her life, she became a first grade teacher and taught the first grade for about 25 years.
Wow!
So that's their story.
Growing up, do you remember them having favorite movies, either that they took you to or watched on TV? Or
the one the movie history I got was from my father because he loved the movies and had seen all of the horror movies, Dracula, Frankenstein. Dracula's Daughter, The Invisible Man, The Mummy.
Yeah. What was your father's name?
Meller Campbell.
Meller?
Meller.
Meller Campbell.
Meller
All right.
Campbell. He took his mother's maiden name was his middle name.
And your mom's name was?
Was Martha Campbell.
Meller and Martha. Okay.
Meller and Martha. Meller and Martha. I got married to Gina. Gina is my wife's name. And a friend gave us a wedding card and said, "Don't cry for me, Arch and Gina."
Arch and Gina. Oh, that's great.
It's Meller and Martha. My father was the movie buff.
He was the movie buff.
He was the movie buff. Loved going.
And mostly horror movies, those Universal ones?
But also the Frank Capra movies, the Hitchcock movies, the Orson Welles movies, all of them. He would go to the movies two or three times a week when he was a young man growing up.
Do you remember the first one you ever went to with him?
It was Snow White.
Really?
Snow White.
Yeah.
And the deal with the witch scared me.
Oh, yeah.
And then we joined a swimming pool on the campus of Incarnate Word University filled with nuns in black habits. And the first time I saw a nun in a black habit, I said, "Oh, my God, it's a witch."
Hide the red apples. Yeah.
apples.
So this must have been a re-release, right? Because it came out in 1937.
Yeah.
So I actually heard I've read that at the Radio City Music Hall premiere, kids had a similar reaction to the witch that you did. When the lights came up, they found that they had peed all over the seats at Radio City. It was that scary.
As they used to say, there wasn't a dry seat in the house.
But for different reasons. Snow White's a great movie after all these years. And Jungle Book just came out today, so it's funny how the legacy.
And then in my neighborhood, we had the Woodlawn Theater, and I would actually bike up there and see what they were showing. So This is silly, but I used to watch the Francis the Talking Mule movies, which are just, terrible now. I remember seeing Pal Joey the movies, and I was like a kid, 10 years old. Whatever they were showing there, I would go and see. We had a movie theater in downtown San Antonio that they have saved, the Majestic. And the Majestic, one of the things about the Majestic is the interior of it was this castle-like thing, with...
like a movie palace.
It literally was a movie palace, opened in 1929.
Yeah.
The ceiling was fashioned to look like the sky.
Wow.
And it closed for a while, and they renovated it and made it a performing arts place. And they asked people for their memories, and people in their memory thought it was an outdoor theater.
Wow.
Because of that, the sky above, the Majestic Theater.
It's like you're at a drive-in.
Yeah. We did go to drive-ins. I remember going to drive-ins in high school to see Goldfinger.
Oh, you saw Goldfinger at a drive-in?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Not only that, I saw Goldfinger at a drive-in in a Nash Rambler, the kind where the seats reclined into a bed. So there were like six of us in this car.
It's like a James Bond car. Yeah, your own gadgets.
So all the seats went all the way back, and we had this a double bed for six of us.
Wow. Yeah, that was 1964 was Goldfinger,
The big movie for us was Psycho.
Oh, yeah.
And
I'm so jealous of you that you got to see that.
And our church group went to see Psycho.
You saw it with your church group?
Yes, at the Texas Theater.
Oh, my God.
Downtown in San Antonio, which was another great movie palace, which is lost, but the facade is still there. Psycho, to me, I have a friend that works for the AARP, and he asked me and Ann Hornaday to pick a list of the 10 most important movies to baby boomers.
Baby boomer,
and, of course, so we all agreed on The Graduate.
Mm-hmm. Great.
But I picked The Godfather and American Graffiti, and I picked Psycho because Psycho was the first really mainstream horror film that played more, it wasn't a drive-in movie. It wasn't a B movie. It was a mainstream.
And they locked the doors.
Big
after
deal.
It started, and there was all this hype. You can't tell the ending, and
I'm going to introduce the documentary Truffaut Hitchcock for the Avalon Theater. The director's coming, and the Avalon is has booked it for their benefit on May 8th. And they got the tapes of the interviews that Truffaut did with Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. Truffaut and Hitchcock became close friends.
Yeah.
And the Truffaut-Hitchcock book, that's like,
film school textbook the Bible. Nowadays.
It is. And so they got these tapes, and every now and then Hitchcock will talk about things he did, and then suddenly he'll start veering into what's going through Jimmy Stewart's mind in Vertigo.
You and I have talked about this. We love
Kim Novak is in the bathroom putting her hair up like the woman, like his
That still might be my favorite scene ever, when she comes out in that green light and there's that circular kiss. And
he starts talking about what's going on while he's waiting her. And then Hitchcock in this documentary says, "Turn off the tape recorder." And what I want to know is, what did he say?
Yeah.
Because I'll say this, since this is being taped anyway, because you probably can't use this, but Hitchcock is telling Truffaut, and Jimmy is waiting there, and as he's waiting for her, he's getting an erection.
For someone who's dead, he thinks is dead. It's an interesting, Hitchcock dealt with some weird stuff. But that movie is just amazing.
That is.
The more you watch it, the more, and it's one of those that, a lot of people, I think, weren't sure how to deal with it the first time around.
Right.
I remember reading early reviews of it, and people were complaining of it's like, A, it's like an ambiguous ending and it's dark, but an unlikable hero at first. But I remember reading something that they were worried of all these awkward angles of ceilings, and they're like, it's too arty. But when you look back at it now, right. Every time he tilts up to see a ceiling, it's because I think he's foreshadowing what Jimmy's not seeing above the bell tower. You know, there's all these little clues, and as he's driving around San Francisco, there's constantly bell towers behind him. There's reds and greens stand for the immortal and the mortal world, and there's just so much going on. I love that movie. We could talk forever, but
Vertigo was a lost film. You know, it fell into copyright problems, and you couldn't see it for many years.
There was like four Hitchcocks that were lost.
Vertigo,
I believe.
And Rope, and I forget what the other two are. I
can't remember if it was Rear Window or what were the four lost ones. But
there were four or five that were lost, and they had to do with copyright. But the big one was Vertigo.
Yeah. So I feel like once that came back out, people took another look at it, and now it's climbed to the top of Sight and Sound list of the Global Critics Poll.
Many people believe it is the greatest movie ever made.
I really love it. Let's go into that. What are some of your greatest?
Now that I don't work all the time, and now that the DVR has been invented, I download a lot of films on Turner Classics.
Yeah.
And I love downloading some of the Orson Welles material, especially Citizen Kane. About every 6 months, I look at Citizen Kane again.
Because every shot has a little symbolic idea going on. It's
every
amazing.
Every time you look at it, you see something else.
Yeah. And not many movies. Most are superficial entertainment runs. This one repays every
Citizen
time.
Citizen Kane really does belong up toward the top. Mm-hmm. I also love Casablanca, and I can watch that
amazing
every time it's
probably
on.
The greatest. Do you agree the greatest script probably ever written? What were those guys having for breakfast? I mean, how many lines? You know, we'll always have Paris, and here's looking at you, kid. And
the waters. There are no waters in Casablanca. I was misinformed.
It's everyone knows the famous play it again, Sam lines and Usual Suspects and all that, but. There's other ones that are like the little nuggets that you don't think of that you catch every other time.
Actually, the line is "Play it, Sam. As time goes by."
Yeah. And Woody Allen and the Marx Brothers changed that one.
That was so great. I was looking at Animal House the other day.
Oh, yeah.
Animal Crackers. The Marx Brothers Animal Crackers. I love that opening scene where they all sing and Marx comes out and sings "Hello, I Must Be Going." And Margaret Dumont comes back with, "If you leave, you'll spoil the party that I'm throwing."
Man, the stuff he would say to Margaret Dumont. What was the one? I think it was in Duck Soup. He says, "I can see you bending over a hot stove, only I can't see the stove." He would just rip into her.
And they claimed she never got a word of it. She never understood.
Oh, man. What is your favorite Marx Brothers movie? Do you have one?
Oh, let's see. I think what's the one? Is it Duck Soup, where they're in Fredonia?
Fredonia, Duck Soup.
Duck Soup. And Duck Soup is relevant to today.
Oh, you know, it's hilarious.
There's this little country, and they invade it. And, you know, there are a lot of references to Duck Soup during some of the more recent wars.
Oh, yeah?
Hail
Fredonia. And then, of course, in Night at the Opera, when they have the stateroom scene where they're all piling in there, that's great. But
and the mirror scene with Groucho and Harpo.
That's Duck Soup, yeah.
Harpo, I read his biography. Harpo was a great intellectual.
Really?
You know, he never talked. One of my favorite movies, and I really would like to see it again, is Mrs. Parker and the Vicious Circle. Did you ever see that?
No, I've never seen that, no.
It was a biography of Dorothy Parker.
Oh, okay.
And the crowd she ran around with, which included Harpo Marx, Alexander Wolcott, and Robert Benchley, and it was an independent film, little scene. Jennifer Jason Leigh, I believe, plays Dorothy Parker.
Wow.
And she recreated Dorothy Parker's voice, which was very kind of Long Island, nasally East Coast. And a lot of people didn't like that at the time, but I just love that they recreated that time.
I'm going to have to check that out.
Mrs. Parker and the Vicious Circle. It's one of those that sticks with me.
There you go. There's a hidden Arch Campbell gem right there.
I love the Hitchcock stuff.
Me too.
And I love the Orson Welles stuff.
Yeah.
And
do you have a favorite scene in Citizen Kane?
You know, I love it when they go on the picnic. We're going, I don't want to go on a picnic, Charlie. We're going on a picnic. And all the cars are creeping up there. And then the guy sings that slow, dirge-like blues number, It Must Be Love.
Yeah.
And the parrot is screeching.
Cockatoo or whatever, wakes you up real quick.
And it's like, God, what is
this? What is going on? It's probably one of the more bizarre scenes in it. Yeah, for sure.
Do you know? Now, I have a story about Citizen Kane. And I want you to follow up on this because Frank Mankiewicz lived in Washington, and many, many people know and love Frank Mankiewicz. Mm-hmm. And I got to know him a little bit just from being around town. And one time I interviewed him, and then we showed Citizen Kane because Frank Mankiewicz's father was Herman Mankiewicz.
Was he brothers with Joseph Mankiewicz?
He was, and Joseph was Frank's uncle.
Okay.
So his
Joseph
father,
made All About Eve. Okay.
Letter to an Unknown Woman. Letter to Three Wives.
Unknown Woman was Max Ophuls.
Right.
Yeah.
The Letter to Three Wives. So Frank Mankiewicz's father wrote Citizen Kane when when JFK opened. Oliver Stone came to town, and by this time Frank Mankiewicz was working for Hill and Knowlton. They decided they would promote JFK by getting the Stokes Commission to release all the assassination tapes or files.
Okay.
So Mankiewicz's idea was to promote JFK through the front page of the paper.
Okay.
So he had an opinion leader's dinner for Oliver Stone, and I was invited.
Wow.
So Stone would come. One table was salad. I think I was the salad table. One table was the main course. One table was dessert. And he would come and sit with us. And, you know, we talked and talked. And during the night, I had to go to the John. So Frank's wife was there. She says, Arch, have you ever held an Oscar? I said, well, no, I haven't. She said, well, come in here. She goes over to a shelf. She says, Frank's father, Herman, won this Oscar for writing the script of Citizen Kane.
She hands
me the Oscar. For Citizen Kane.
Are you kidding me?
No. And
where are you? Or where? How? You're at
you
there?
Know, he's in a beautiful condo over in Adams Morgan.
Oh, my God. And the Oscar? It was in Adams Morgan?
Yes. Now, I went back to talk to Frank about that Oscar. And incidentally, Oscars are heavy.
That's crazy.
I went back to talk to Frank about the Oscar, and they had sold it.
Really? Like Jake LaMotta selling his belt.
Yeah. When I interviewed him at the museum, I asked him to bring the Oscar, and he said he couldn't because of insurance problems. So I think that's why they got rid of it. Maybe they sold it back to the Academy. I don't know. Ben Mankiewicz comes to town because he introduces the films on Turner Classics.
TCM. Yeah, him
and
Robert
one of these days, you will cross paths with him, and I want you to ask him for me, what happened to the Oscar for Citizen Kane?
Ooh, yeah, because it's a mystery now.
Well, it's a mystery to me.
Yeah.
But Ben would know.
Maybe he has it.
I think they sold it.
Interesting.
I think that's what Frank told me later on.
Okay.
So, but for a while, the Oscar for the screenplay of Citizen Kane was on a shelf in a beautiful condominium in
Adams
Morgan.
That is amazing.
Isn't that great?
You can eat jumbo slice pizza and hold the Citizen Kane Oscar. That's America. Oh, that is great. All right. Off the top of your head, what are some of your other favorites? We've mentioned the Hitchcocks. We've mentioned Citizen Kane.
You know, it's a hard question. What's your favorite movie?
Exactly.
How do you answer?
There's so many great ones.
You know, and you say, oh, it's the last one I saw. Well, no, it's not the last one I saw.
To me, it's like, The correct answer is probably it changes every week.
It does, yes.
But there's certain ones you circle back to.
One of the movies,
The Godfather.
Uh-huh.
And Godfather 2.
Yeah.
Similar to Citizen Kane, I think every time I return to them, I find new stuff in the background.
Godfather 1 and 2, actually, you can watch over and over and over again. And that is certainly,
a combined piece of work, it might be the greatest movie ever made.
Now, did you see that thing? Somebody was showing the Godfather epic. Where they put 1, 2, and 3 together in chronological
Re-edited,
order.
Yeah. So it opens with the Ellis Island with Vito as a boy, and then goes to. Yeah.
And they added a few scenes that that were outtakes. It was like 9 hours worth, and I loved it. I loved watching it. I could watch the whole 9 hours.
I think it's absolutely brilliant.
I do too.
I noticed. Did you? And speaking of noticing new things every time you watch it, so everyone knows Luca Brasi sleeps with the fishes, right? Everyone knows that scene where they show the fish, but. Coppola's foreshadowing that stuff. When the scene where he gets choked out in the bar, remember they stab him through the hand and then Coppola shoots it. There's fish patterns on the window when he shoots it. Or in part two where Michael disowns Fredo before the famous kiss and everything. Yeah. But or no, it's after the famous kiss. Fredo's laying down at Lake Tahoe and there's like a in front of a big window. Michael walks in and Michael stands and There's they look like life preservers behind Michael out the window, but behind Fredo there's none, and it's like you're done, Fredo.
I noticed new things. Fredo. I know it was you.
You broke my heart. It's one of the great, and it's like
you're the only guy I know who could say you broke my heart.
Yeah.
In unison with me, I love that.
And then he gives him the big Judas to Jesus kiss of betrayal.
Oh,
yeah.
It's, God.
But even more heartbreaking is prior to that. When they're out at the club and they're all drinking with a congressman, remember they're watching the show, and Fredo just happens to let it slip that old man Roth and Johnny Oliver, and you see on Michael's face, he just lowers his head and realizes what he has to do. And to me, they might be my favorite. Although many times I've said Vertigo as well, but that's
it is Shakespearean, The Godfather.
Yeah.
It's Shakespearean.
It
really is, and it's you know, particularly it's Macbeth.
Yeah, well, and just the notions of. Just the son becomes the father, the father the son, you know, and I never wanted this for you, but he ends up becoming even worse than his dad. And then plus you have, I mean, there's just the cast too. I mean, how you're going to have Brando, Pacino, De Niro in the second one, Khan, Duvall, Diane Keaton, Talia Shire, I mean, everybody.
And, you know, Diane Keaton at the time was really known as a comedian for her funny stuff.
Right.
And she has great range, and she's... and. You never think, that's Woody Allen's funny girlfriend from the time you saw it.
Right.
Now, looking back, the movies of the 70s, when you see the movies of the 70s, they blow me away.
It's still my favorite period.
One time I downloaded They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
Yeah, yeah.
And I showed it to
my wife,
Jane Fonda, and I read it's considered one of the greatest cinema examples of existentialism ever. And the way it ends, they would not do that today.
I know.
They would not
they
make that
They pushed a lot
today.
Of boundaries back then in ways that I think studio execs would get a hold of today and make them change it in the boardroom.
That is the good thing about the independent film movement. At least they will they'll push things.
Yeah.
As opposed to the commercial movies now.
So that's your favorite period then is the 70s. I remember there was that book Easy Riders and Raging Bull.
Yeah.
So but to me it was a little bit earlier. I'd sort of cap it at I'd say 67 because that's Bonnie and Clyde, The Graduate, In the Heat of the Night.
Heat of the Night, by the way, is an overlooked movie that had tremendous impact at the time and plays as well today as it did in 1967.
Yeah, and they had to shoot it in Sparta, Illinois instead of Sparta, Mississippi.
Yeah.
They were that far ahead. Norman Jewison.
And so, yeah, Sidney I would Poitier. Go with you. 67 through what? The early
what do you
80s?
Think? Maybe. Well, 80 was Raging Bull with. I mean, there's been. Caveat. There's been a lot of great movies we love since, but we're not knocking those movies. But we're saying we think the cream of the crop, 67 to 80?
Maybe 80. Yeah. You know, when did Body Heat come out?
81.
Loved Body Heat.
Yeah. That's sort of a double indemnity thing to it, right? Oh, that's a great
love
movie.
Love double indemnity.
Well, that's the thing. So we're saying this, but then actually when I stop and think, a lot of the great movies we've mentioned were in the 40s as well. And, so.
When I was in Los Angeles, you should do this. I drove to Glendale to see the train station where he gets on the train in Double Indemnity just to see it. Just to see what it looks like.
You mean
like.
Where he jumps out onto the tracks?
The train comes in and he's on the crutches and he gets on the train there.
Yeah.
It's the Glendale Amtrak station.
Wow.
It was the Southern Pacific station and at the time, and it's still there.
I got to do it. One of my favorite movies, Double Indemnity. I mean, Barbara Stanwyck as Phyllis Dietrichson is so creepy
and so against type.
Yeah.
For her, and also
she just done Lady Eve right before.
Yeah,
which was like a comedy. Yeah, but it's such a great movie.
Also, I love the movie Being There.
Oh yeah,
and I've watched that over and over and over. Now, time has not been
with Peter Sellers.
I think it was the last movie he shot.
Might have been. It was 1979.
Time has not been kind to Being There because now with the internet and the iPhone, so much information is available, and Peter Sellers' Chance the Gardener is able to come out of nowhere.
Right.
And nobody have any information.
You couldn't do it, yeah.
That interferes with watching the movie today.
Yeah. How about some other ones you like? I feel like I'm trying to think. We've had this conversation before. Oh, you're a big fan of Last Picture Show.
Oh,
it's a great
another
movie.
Another one from the 70s.
71.
That they would not make today.
Yeah.
And I loved The Last Picture Show so much that I drove to Archer City, Texas. Just to look at it.
I'm sensing a theme. You go visit these movie set
locations. I want to see these locations. I really do. I had a friend who lived in L.A. who worked for Warner Brothers for a while, and he was a movie nut. And he was going to take me to the stairs that Laurel and Hardy are pulling the piano up.
Oh, God.
What is that? The piano?
The music?
The music box. The music box.
I don't know how I pulled that one. That's like the early 30s.
Very nice.
Good
very
stuff.
Very nice.
Laurel and Hardy were great, too. No, I mean, I kind of did the same thing when I was out for covering the Oscars this year. I drove to the street where the final shot in Chinatown, you know, another one of my favorite movies, where, you know, Jack Nicholson is out there on the street and Faye Dunaway gets it shot through the eye.
And that's from our period. That's from 73, I think, or
I think 74. It was 74. Yeah, it was... I think it might have won the script for Robert Town, but it lost because it was Godfather 2. So,
yeah.
I mean, when a movie like Chinatown doesn't win Best Picture, that's when you know you're in a good era because
And
the
then,
competition.
You know, they did a sequel and it never came as close
the two
as
Jakes,
Chinatown.
Right?
Yeah.
Town directed the sequel, I believe.
I think so, yeah.
I think, I mean, his personal life is a whole different story, but Polanski's movies, at least like Rosemary's Baby, Chinatown, are amazing to me.
I have never been as frightened as I was after watching Rosemary's Baby.
I think it's, you know, a lot of people...
And they never show you.
Exactly. That's why it's great.
Which is scarier.
I'm obsessed with that movie every time, you know, because a lot of people hold up the slasher movies and Freddy Krueger's and whatever, Rosemary's Baby hits you on a psychological level. Mm-hmm. And again, another one where you notice things the more you watch it. And Ruth Gordon in that movie as the neighbor, Minnie Kastavitz.
And she won.
She won for that.
The Oscar for that.
Yeah,
and her speech was, "This is such an encouraging development."
Yeah, well, because she and Garson Kanin.
Like 85.
They wrote. Remember, they were writers. They wrote Adam's Rib for Hepburn Tracy, and then I guess Harold and Maude was after Rosemary's Baby. That was another great movie, Harold and Maude, from that period we're talking about.
With another movie that they would not make today.
No.
They
the
wouldn't
age
make
difference.
It.
Yeah, they would say.
You know, I mourn the commercial nature of the majority of movies today. Yeah. I mourn
too safe.
That they're so safe.
Too prepackaged.
They're like, they're marketing oriented. Yeah. They're focus grouped. Right.
Based on an existing product, and you don't want to rock the boat too much because you want to make sure there's a sequel. And a
focus group can't tell you what they'll like.
Exactly.
People can't tell you what they're going to like
until they see it. Yeah.
And yet, too many movies are being based on what they think people will like.
I agree.
I mourn that. But there is the independent movement, and there are the small movies. And... you know, you just have to pick and choose.
Is there something from recent years that really knocked you out outside of this period where this, you know, the Hollywood Renaissance period?
You know, another one in the Renaissance, All the President's Men.
Great movie.
Also from the
another
Renaissance.
Another one from that. Yeah.
And plays as well today as it did back then.
Yeah.
And reminded me of Spotlight.
Yeah. Or vice versa.
So as much as I like Spotlight, I felt like we'd already seen it with All the President's Men.
I love Spotlight, and definitely, I thought it was a great movie. But yeah, I mean, when everyone wrote those reviews, they were comparing it to All the President's Men.
And I'm going to have to think long and hard about a movie that just really excited me in the last few years.
Well, what are some of your other favorites over the years?
We've hit a lot of them. We've really hit a lot of them.
Yeah. Well, take me, let's go more in the Arch Campbell, This Is Your Life category. So you told me, you're growing up in San Antonio. You started working at, what was the TV station where you raised your hand and said, I'll review movies?
I grew up in San Antonio. I took a speech class as a senior in high school, and I had a driven drama teacher who got a hold of me and said, okay, kid, I want you to MC our talent show. So I went out as the MC. I'd never been on stage before. And it was the first time I was really treated as an adult. I'd get together with this drama teacher, Jean Longwith is her name. We'd get together at first period, me and about 10 other people, and we wrote the script for the show. Mm-hmm. So we'd bat around ideas. She would get out a mimeograph thing. She starts typing, the thing. I got carte blanche to do bad jokes between acts, and it hooked me. And I followed her to a junior college, San Antonio College, where she started a public radio station. And she had a lot of anger because she was discriminated against as a woman. If she were alive today, I think she'd be running a studio or a network or something like that. She was that much of a dynamo. What she did do is she left a legacy of a public radio station in San Antonio, KSYM, and it's an alternative music station now. And I stayed in touch with her my entire life. She got me interested in radio. From radio, I was working at a station, WFAA, in Dallas, and I was able to get into television news there. And in Dallas, my niche was an old guy, a well-known news guy named Bert Shipp, took me aside. Bert Shipp's camera is in the Assassination Museum because he covered the Kennedy assassination. Yeah. One of his stories is he got a cameraman in the sixth floor building after the shooting.
At the book depository?
And the guy is up there on the sixth floor, and Bert is down on the ground, and the guy unloads his camera, wraps up the film, and throws it down six floors to Bert, who catches it.
Oh, my God.
Runs it over to the processor.
Wow.
What a day that was.
Well, I know a lot of people's careers start. Bob Schieffer started that. I think he drove Lee Harvey's mom to the news
station. Lee Harvey's
mom
called him. He took the call, went over, and picked her up.
Wow. Okay, well, tell me about when you...
Bert Shipp takes me aside. He says, look, everybody in this newsroom can cover a wreck or a fire. He says, if you can do a feature story, you can find a niche for yourself. So I became the feature reporter on the TV station on Channel 8 News in Dallas. Mm-hmm. And that's when we got a new news director, a famous guy named Marty Haig, who is now considered possibly one of the greatest local news directors who ever worked. He's no longer alive. He's the one. He would come in every morning and scream at us because we were all about 26, 27. We were in there smoking cigarettes. You know, everybody's smoking and
smoking
throwing
cigarettes
things
and
at
watching
each other and misbehaving. And he would scream at us, do this, do that, do this. And then one morning he screamed, I want a movie reviewer who wants to do it. As I think about it over the years, I think he knew that I wanted to do it.
And he had a hunch.
I think he knew that I was the guy to do it, but he opened the door for me.
Were you wearing the fedora at the time?
I was not wearing the fedora because I had a massive head of hair over my collar.
He still does under that hat. No,
and I have the memory of it. Yeah. And that's how I got into movie review.
Okay, so you raised your hand and you started doing it. Do you remember the first one you had to go review?
Yes, the very first movie I ever reviewed was American Graffiti.
Oh, my
and
God.
It's one of
That's
the
a
movies,
good one out of the box.
It is one of the movies that I picked for the 10 most important for baby boomers because they made it. It was only 7 or 8 years past the period of the 60s, but it identified that period as something very important, the time right before the Beatles and right before the Vietnam War.
Well, it's set in 62, right?
Where were you in 62? Yeah. So, and it was came out in 73, 11 years later.
Yeah.
Now, today in 2016, you wouldn't make a movie about 2005, right. I don't think.
Right.
But that period was so important, and Lucas.
Well, yeah, Boyhood. But yeah, I know what you're saying.
Lucas got that time was so important, and that the music was so big.
Yeah.
And I think it was one of the first movies to really showcase popular music of the time.
Like a wall-to-wall
soundtrack.
It was
like a character in the thing. It launched so many careers.
Richard Dreyfuss, Harrison Ford.
Suzanne Summers
is the girl in the car. Yeah.
It also identified...
Ron Howard. Let's not
Ronnie
forget.
Ronnie Howard. Yeah. Wow. It got that cars were so important in those days. Yeah. I mean... You're going to make a movie where everybody drives a 2005 Acura now?
Wolfman Jack, I don't think so. Got that, the radio thing.
Right.
And it was all, what was cool, it was there was no, and I remember Lucas was, had said this about that he had a hard time getting made because there was no quote-unquote plot. It was one night following a group of high school, or I guess it was their right night before they go to leaves for college, right?
And then he updated the characters at the end, and I think that was the first movie. You know, now you see afterwards
it's
all
old hat
the time.
Now,
But that was the first one, and people actually sat there and sat through the credits.
Yeah.
You know, to get the update on the characters.
And that,
you
of course, enabled Star Wars and Indiana Jones and everything else he's had his hand in. So
one of my favorite things to do now when I go to the movies, not, all those years I was on Channel 4 especially, I was in a hurry. I'd sit in the back, and as soon as the movie was over, I'd be out like a light to get back to the station, to go on because I immediately went on the air. One of the things I really love doing now is sitting there watching the credits.
Yeah.
And sometimes I will be the last to leave the theater, just to let it sink in.
You ruminate on the power of the movie, the message of the movie while you're sitting there?
You know, it's like, and I want to see the cast. I want to read the names of the cast. And if it's a movie I really love... I just love sitting there.
Soak it in a little longer. That's good advice. Yeah. A lot of people, including myself, will bolt and start writing the review.
I don't have to anymore.
I'll take that. How did you land the job at Four after working down in San Antonio?
I worked with another really great newsman named Don Harris, and he was the anchor man at the station in Dallas. Don Harris went to KNBC in Los Angeles. I started sending tapes out, trying to get a job. I was trying to get into Chicago, New York, L.A. I really wanted to go to L.A. And Don Harris recommended me to a guy from L.A. who was coming to Channel 4 named Bruce McDonald. And that is what got me on his radar. I sent him a tape, and he hired me over the phone. Don Harris is well known in broadcast history because he was the reporter at Jonestown died in the Jonestown Massacre.
Wow.
And one of the things, I never laugh at the phrase, drink the Kool-Aid,
because
of my friend Don Harris. And he's the reason I'm here. And he was a...
Wow. They did an amazing documentary on that recently. What was it? The Jonestown Legend of the...
The cameraman survived.
Great. Yeah.
And so the film survived. And the cameraman had great issues with the fact that he survived and so many other people
didn't. Survivor's guilt. Yeah. Wow. But anyway, he gave you...
It's Don Harris is who got me here. Bruce McDonald said, I don't want a movie reviewer. I want you to do features. And I did a lot of really unusual, semi-outrageous things at Channel 4, including my boss read a story about miniature pigs that had been developed for the agriculture department to do tests on, or maybe it was the NRH, I don't know, NIH. Somebody had developed these miniature pigs, and then they decided, we're not gonna use them. So they had these pigs they needed to get rid of, and he said, well, you should get one and raise it as a pet, and we'll do stories on it. Yeah. So I got this little pig, and I raised it in my house. Pigs are very clean. So I put it in one corner of a room in the basement, and then I put newspaper in the other corner. I would feed him on one corner. He would I paper trained him. By going to the other corner, I could put him on a leash, and I named him Spot. And I did all these stories about Spot the pig. And there was an event here, the Solo Singing Dog Contest.
Wow.
And I took Spot the pig to the Solo Singing Dog Contest because he looked like a little dog.
You entered the pig?
Yeah.
It's like Babe.
All you had
That'll
to do
pig.
Is pick him up and he would squeal. So I sang a chorus of Am I Blue? Am I Blue? And then I would pick him up. He would go, ah! Am I Blue? And then pick him up. And I got on the CBS News that night. That's nationally.
Hilarious. Wow.
I got on the ABC News nationally. I was all over town.
Wow.
I had my competition was Henry Tannenbaum on Channel 9, who was a brilliant, talented feature guy.
Yeah.
He was there. He saw that. He went back and said, I got nothing. We got scooped. We can't run anything.
Can't beat the singing pig.
We can't do this.
Well, then when did the movie reviewing start?
And the singing pig, finally, I had to give away, and I took him out to this the Preston Country Club for Pets. It's out on Route 29, and I let him go, and we filmed him in slow motion and put Born Free under it. The pig is... loping out there.
Oh, that's great.
So I was in kind of the wilderness for 4 or 5 years, and I'm going to give you the long version of this story
if you want it. Let's hear it.
Nobody wanted to do the morning cut-ins during the Today Show, because you had to get up early, and then you had to go out and be a reporter. So it was a killer schedule. It was 12 hours a day. So I went in and I said, I want to do the cut-ins. Because I was trying to get my career going anyway, somehow, doing anything. So I started going in, doing the early morning news on Channel 4 before the Today Show and then during the Today Show. And there was a massive snowstorm, the snowstorm of George Washington's birthday, 1979.
Okay.
And it still ranks, its rank is higher than the one we had this winter.
Wow.
And it was in 79, so it was before there was really state-of-the-art weather forecasting. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know it was coming. So I got in at 5 a.m. A couple or three other people got in at 5 a.m. We were working there. It starts snowing and snowing and snowing. The snowstorm started about 4:30.
Okay.
And nobody could get to work.
Oh.
So we were the only people in there. So that evening... the weekend weather guy I'm going to tell this. Paul Anthony lived a couple of miles away, and he walked in to Channel 4 to do the weather because Willard was the weatherman, and Willard lived way out in Paris, Virginia, and couldn't get in. So Paul created all this stuff, and he had all this explanation for the weather, And that night the news started, and came time for the weather, and they called up Willard. Willard started laughing, telling jokes, and Willard went on for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and Paul Anthony never got on the air, and it infuriated him. So he went in and he quit.
Wow.
He resigned on the spot. So the next day I'm in there doing the early morning news. The news director comes in, another wacky guy named Dave Newell. He says, Arch, have you ever done the weather? I had done it once, but I said, oh, yeah,
all
sure,
the time.
Sure. He says, fine, you're the weekend weatherman. I started doing the weather on the weekend. They started seeing me on camera. And at the end of the 80s, Willard Scott left Channel 4. Mm-hmm. They had tried to hire Gordon Peterson away from Channel 9, mm-hmm. and that didn't work. Sue Simmons was on Channel 4, the famous New York anchor. She left. all the big names left, and the station was basically in the position of starting over.
Yeah.
And I had kept going into Newell saying, I used to review movies. I want to review movies. So finally he says, okay, let's try it. So I went out and reviewed, I think I reviewed American Gigolo.
Oh, okay.
And Vance liked the review. Vance thought it was cool that we were in a review movie, so that I was going to do it. So Vance kind of supported me.
Oh, okay.
And that's how I got started. And in 1980, as I started reviewing movies, they hired Bob Ryan. Bob came to take Willard's place, and they hired George Michael.
Wow.
And so suddenly me and Bob and George and Vance worked together on the 11 o'clock news for 26 years.
And a new era was born right in 1980, right there.
And I don't think it'll ever happen again, because I don't think you will ever put together a team and that team will stay.
Yeah. A different time.
As long as we did. Now people, you know, things change, people move.
Yeah.
But that was one of the secrets of Channel 4, that we were all there so long.
Yeah. Talk about sort of the secret. When you approach each of those reviews for the nightly cast, because you know that you had, like we said earlier, there's a lot of eyeballs there. You're leading into Carson, for God's
and
sake.
And not only did I have a big audience, but I also had to keep those four guys interested.
Right.
Vance, George, and Bob. And if I lost them, I was lost. Vance went through several partners. He had a great partner, Dave Marish, and then Doreen. And once Doreen came, everything really gelled.
Yeah.
But I had to keep their attention.
They were your test. Yeah,
I was playing to those people. And when I would write a review, I would think, how am I going to get this over to Vance? How am I going to get this across to George Michael?
Right.
How am I going to keep their attention without them throwing things at me? How am I going to keep... Now, Doreen... has always been the nicest of those people, and she was always supportive. But the thing was, how do you keep their attention?
If you could win them over, you'd win over the viewers.
And you know, and I did theater as well as movies and stories too. But I was always happy that I could put theater reviews on the air.
Yeah.
And in the 80s, because downtown, you know. You had the riots in Washington in 1968, and then you had the building of the Metro, which tore up downtown. Downtown looked like a war zone for years because they were digging the Metro. Mm-hmm. And by the time they finished, there was downtown was almost a wasteland. Empty stores, empty places, empty lots. And because there was so much empty space... That paved the way for so many small theater companies to come in because the space was there. It was empty. You know, the Landsberg department store was sitting there empty. They had a place, DC Space, I think. They did little cabaret shows.
Mm-hmm.
Woolly Mammoth and The Source started up on 14th Street. You go over to 14th Street to park. The street was empty.
Wow.
You could park on either side of it. And you know, that spawned the theater movement, and I was around to cover that. So, I'm grateful for that.
That's great. That's what I've and part of my gig doing it here. It's been one of the most rewarding things is doing all the shows. And I guess maybe people that aren't down here don't really realize it, that it's how rich it is. You have Kennedy Center, National Theater, Warner Theater, Arena Stage, Roundhouse Theater. There's the one over in Shirlington, Signature Theater. There's all over the place.
Signature is terrific.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
And then there's Woolly Mammoth and the studio.
Not to mention Ford's Theater, the historic one. So,
About every 3 years, I'd go over to Ford's Theater because they would, Frankie Hewitt, who was Don Hewitt's ex-wife, renovated Ford's Theater and got it up and running again. It was empty for years. And she put authentic chairs in it. Everybody complained about the chairs at Ford's Theater. God, that thing is uncomfortable. So about every 3 years, they'd change the chairs. One time, Tip O'Neill actually got, I think, some of the grant to put more comfortable chairs with cushions in Ford's theater.
That's hilarious. Yeah. You said something really interesting earlier that I want to come back to now, that sort of when you're approaching it, you were saying how you wanted to sort of review for the average Joe, which
right.
I think is important. I think too many times, I mean, I feel like critics, I don't want to maybe not say we get a bad rap because maybe there's a lot of kernels of truth in there. A lot of times you feel you find some critics that seem to talk down to listeners or readers or seem to kind of cross a little snobby. I went to film school. I know, you know. So tell me about, you know, the importance of, and I'm sure we both have tried to do this so long, some better than others, but, you know, combining sort of our knowledge base, our deep knowledge,
right,
but also
right.
talking
and
like an and passion.
Right.
But just talking to, you know, colloquially.
Well, I was in television.
Conversationally.
And so in television, I had a minute and change, a minute 15, first it was minute 30, then a minute 15, then a minute 5. So you had to compress everything. Mm-hmm. You had to get a clear message across. Mm-hmm. And in the 80s and 90s, and even now, there are a lot of really smart intellectual critics mm-hmm. working.
For sure.
In the 80s, I remember when Gary Arnold was the reviewer for the Washington Post, and he reviewed The Empire Strikes Back, mm-hmm. and they gave him the front half of the style section, and then an entire page on the inside. I mean, he wrote a treatise on The Empire Strikes Back. He loved that movie. So did I, by the way. And the Washington Post has brought so many talented people to those pages. Rita Kempley, I love Rita Kempley, is one of the writers who had the great humor. She had the humor of Dorothy Parker. She had a common touch, but she also had great depth of knowledge. Paul Attanasio went on to write screenplays, but he was the reviewer at the Washington Post, and Stephen Hunter. It's just one of the greatest writers I've ever read. And now Anne Hornaday, I think Anne Hornaday is the voice for movies in Washington because not only does she review, but she also takes on issues or trends.
Yeah.
The end of the romantic comedy.
Yeah.
Or the... the challenge for the romantic comedy.
She's a great writer. We have
she
her on
really
COP
is.
All the time, too.
I think the world of her. Yeah. So given that, I would need to occupy a different position.
Right.
And
carve out your own niche.
I wanted to sound like the guy who'd just come out of the theater, and very often I was because I had just gotten back, and I wanted to be the guy who said, this is good, go see it.
Right.
That's a different stance than someone writing, a treatise, criticism. So I always thought I was a reviewer, and some of the people I admired the most were doing criticism.
Right, yeah. Yeah. And is it possible to sort of have a little bit of a balance to that? If you had advice for other people coming up, you know, that want to be reviewers, do they have to pick one or the other, or is there a way to...
I like A.O. Scott in the New York Times a lot, and I think he satisfies both areas. I think he's awfully good. I like him. I loved Roger Ebert's reviews.
He's great.
Especially toward the end, once he lost his voice, ironically, I think his writing got better.
Yeah.
He was a beautiful writer.
He was great.
I like his website, too. I like the people that write for his website.
Yeah, I remember towards the end, he made that his website had a great movies section where he would go back and do a new review on the great ones. Yeah, he was fantastic. We actually talked to when Steve James made the documentary, Life Itself.
Yeah.
James and me and one of Ebert's childhood friends, and his name's escaping me, were on stage. It was at AFI
right.
Docs.
Yes, yes.
And you really got an appreciation for Ebert as the man, too, in addition to the critic. But, man, talk about a guy that spanned, you know, from starting as a newspaper writer to him and Siskel and Ebert on TV, which was like sort of your era at four, and then even made it onto the web, too.
Interestingly, they never were able to replicate Siskel and Ebert.
Yeah.
They never could get two people together. And I think it's because Siskel and Ebert really didn't like each other.
Oh, the outtakes in that movie show it. They were going
really
at it.
They really were competitors.
Yeah.
And they really, you know, they had no use for each other.
Yeah.
And they really disagreed. And it was great.
Yeah. It's like us, man. Campbell and Fraley. We, no, I don't. We actually get along.
We get along.
We're great friends.
And I love talking to you.
Yeah. Talk about sort of the state of criticism now. I mean, what have you been up to these days? Oh, well, we didn't mention your time at Channel 7, right? So after 4, you went to 7. And
I was at Channel 4
for the Arch Campbell show.
32 years at Channel 4.
Yeah.
And really broke my heart to leave.
Yeah.
But I had to leave. And when people see me, some people think I'm still on there. It's been 10 years
You're an
since
institution.
I left there.
Yeah.
And, you know, then that sadness was amplified when George Michael died not long after that. George left, and then Bob left, and they do a great job, but it's a completely different era at Channel 4. Channel 7 was nice enough to hire me. So they extended my time on TV another 8 years, and they were so nice to me at Channel 7. They gave me a little office, and people would come in and visit, and, you know, what's it like? And I kind of became, the oldest member.
The sage advice,
like P.G. Woodhouse's oldest member.
Yeah.
And I inherited an entertainment show at Channel 8. And I'd been reviewing movies so long that I was kind of tired of being the reviewer.
Right.
And I was able to take that show and bring other reviewers on.
Right.
Which and then I was able to bring actors on.
Yeah.
And I was sort of able to turn that forum over to other people and still get the information out. And the show I did on Channel 8, which also let me do a bit of comedy, which is really
Angus Lamond, man. Is this
Lamond
a real guy, or is
he
this
is
your
a real guy?
Really? He gets a shout out every show, or did?
Because I would make up letters that they would bring in. And that is probably the most fun I ever had.
Yeah, I bet.
I had a show on Channel 4 after Saturday Night Live during the 80s.
Was it syndicated?
It was nationally a local show, and it really got pretty good ratings. And then
was that called the Arch Campbell Show as well?
The Arch Campbell Show. NBC brought Showtime at the Apollo in, so that ran after Saturday Night Live, and they ran this local show of mine at 1 a.m., and it still got ratings because people, I think, were out of their minds if they were watching TV then. And I took some of the things I learned there and put them on the little Channel 8 show. And the show I did the last 3 years I worked at 7 and 8, which are together, was the most fun I ever had.
Really?
And the most satisfying I ever had.
It was, let me tell you, I can't speak for all the other guests that came on, guest reviewers and things, but I had a blast coming on there. It was so much fun because it was sort of that laid back, you know, we were going to give you good insights in the movies, but it was also so much fun. And the jokes, reading your jokes that you had for us, we didn't know what was going to be in that envelope, but you knew it was going to be something that was going to make you laugh.
And I liked the off-screen laughter, you know, and I think it made it more intimate.
Yeah.
That it was sort of like, I mean, you know, it looked like a cable access show. There were hardly any, not many visuals to it.
Yeah.
One of the things that happened is we would start out and the first guest would be in front. We started doing that show. I started asking the director if we could pretty much just do it in front of a green screen.
Right.
And then just screw around with the background.
Right.
So Dave Barry came in. And we would start, and the first guest would be in front of a green screen, and I'd be over there, and they'd have a double box like Nightline used to do.
Yeah.
And then I started referring to this expensive remote we had arranged, and, you know, it wasn't a remote. We were right in, and everybody knew I was pulling their leg. Dave Barry is there. He says, I start talking about the expensive remote, and I think we made it look like either he was at Kennedy Center or in Miami.
No.
And we started talking, and I don't know, I kind of got a hair in my behind, and I got out of my box while they stayed on the double box and walked over there into his box to show him how to do it. And he walked out of his box and walked over to where I was and got in my box. So we traded places on the remote.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And I loved that moment. So that was a lot of fun. Yeah. That was a lot of fun.
What are you up to these days? Let's see. You said you were born in 46, so that's 2016. What are you? You're on approaching 70?
I'm just about to turn 70.
Wow. Well, there you go. Now we have the peg for the piece. Arch at 70.
Oh, God.
No, but,
how did that happen?
You're still doing it, though. God. You know, what are you up to these days? We're doing a panel this week.
I'm on the board of the D.C. Film Festival because they asked me to go on the board, and I really look forward to that. And, you know, I'm using that as a forum to connect the D.C. Film Fest to D.C. I take classes at the Writers' Center in Bethesda, and I'm doing some writing. Every now and then I give a speech here or there, and I'm looking for my next gig. I'm still not quite ready to quit.
Right.
I think my days of reviewing movies are over because I'm 70 years old, and most of the movies are made for people a third of that age or maybe a fourth of that age. I still love going to the movies, and I still go to screenings. I keep a website.
Keep the website up, archcampbell.org. Like
archcampbell.org, and I'm also on DC Outlook, another website.
Yeah.
So that's good. I had some radio gigs, but WTOP ran all the other radio stations out of business. So
we're just
you've
good
got
at what
the
we
gig
do.
Here, and, yeah. and you deserve to have it. You're the best at it, so... So I'm busy. I'm doing as much as I want, and I'm particularly enjoying writing. But I'm also looking for a gig. So if anybody has something that's a lot of fun and that pays a lot of money,
not necessarily
I would
love... movies, anything entertainment. Okay.
Just you know, I'm,
maybe
I'm,
someone listened to this. Well, you know, we'll have an avenue there. I don't know, something.
I can be the announcer on your podcast.
Okay.
And now here's Jason Fraley.
And
Jason,
there's Arch Campbell.
A viewer, Angus Wan, writes, Jason, he wants to know, what's your favorite movie?
It's actually not a bad idea. We get old Angus and you on. I love it. I love it. You mentioned writing. You're talking at the Writing Center. You're talking about writing plays for the stage, or what do we got going on?
Oh,
is there anything we're allowed to share yet, or is it still in?
I had a great idea for a play, but we couldn't quite make it work. I wrote a piece that the Washingtonian printed about the Garden of the Roma. The Roma was this outrageous Italian restaurant across from the Uptown Theater, and they had a garden behind it. And every September they would have La Vendemnia, where they would celebrate the new wine. And there was an accordionist back there, and a soprano would sing tuned, you know, highlights from La Traviata. And there was they'd have a barrel of grapes, and people would get in the grape barrel and stomp, and there was music and laughter and dancing, and that garden remains. The Roma closed, but the garden is behind the Firehook Bakery on Connecticut, across from
the
Uptown. Yeah. And I often wonder if people go back there and if they have any idea what used to go on. It was literally... It was a sitcom, so and the Washingtonian published that piece.
Oh, that's cool.
I went back to San Antonio, and my mother lived in the same house for 45 years, and I knew her in that house from when I was 5 until I was 50, and the people who bought it have been there 20 years. And they invited me back to visit.
This is recently?
Recently. Oh. And I'm trying to make sense of that on the page. It was really awesome.
Coming home,
I walked up to the guy. I said, I am the ghost of West Mistletoe Street. And he laughed. And as I think about it, I realize the neighborhood and the house, I am one of the ghosts of West Mistletoe Street.
Ah, I like it. I want to see where this goes here, sir.
And, you know, the ghosts are friendly. They're friendly ghosts. Mm-hmm. But I think my father and mother are still in that house.
Really?
Yeah.
There you go. And he's, that's perfect. Bring it full circle. He's still watching Frankenstein movies, the ghost of the father.
He is.
It's a Wonderful Life is playing on a wall somewhere there in ghostly form. Well, I think that's the perfect way to end it. We just came full circle. You got to keep me posted what you do with that story. I'm very intrigued. I like a good ghost story. Arch Campbell.
You get a podcast and show me how to get one, and I'll read my ghost stories.
Yeah. Yeah, we need to get you on. We need to get you podcasting.
I love seeing more people getting on the air covering entertainment. Mm-hmm. I had my run, and I don't mind. I am happy stepping aside. There was a day when 4, 5, 7, and 9, all of us were out reviewing movies and theater and seeing each other. Now there are people on this, an entertainment reporter on 7 and 9, mm-hmm. and there's Kevin McCarthy
on
5.
Yeah.
And I'm glad to see that, and I want to see more of that. And I love what you're doing here on WTOP. Entertainment is important.
Thank you,
it's
sir.
Part of the culture.
Thank
I'm
you,
glad you're doing what you do.
Well, all of the people you just named, we learn from the best. Arch Campbell. And you're not done yet, sir.
No. I'm ready.
Ready.
I'm out there.
He's out there.
Find me on Facebook.
The truth is out there. All right, Arch, thanks so much. You're generous with your time. Hopefully your car didn't get ticketed.
Yeah, I put a note on it. I parked at a broken meter.
Hi, I'm Arch Campbell. Don't ticket me. Thank you, sir.
You are welcome. Anytime. Anything for you, Jason. All you right. are very welcome.
No, anything for you, Arch.